Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Well, I am well. I am in Park City, Utah, as you know.
Yes. How are things in Park City and how are things at Press Camp?
Press Camp is nothing less than remarkable. I mean, you know, I had high expectations and I thought it was going to be fun, but I had no idea. The planning, the location, the food, the accommodations, and especially the vendors, it's just been remarkable.
Cool.
Yeah. And so they affectionately, the journalists, all of us, affectionately refer to Press Camp as Schwagfest.
You have some samples and some parting gifts, as they say?
Right, Don Pardo. How about some parting gifts? I can't even imagine what this bag weighs. First of all, we got a great big bag, and it had stuff in it. But then every time you went to interview one of the vendors, which is very cool because you get this one-on-one and they're 45-minute slots. So it's not like you pass them in the aisle at Interbike and get 2 minutes here and 3 minutes there. This is really focused stuff. And every one of them has this gift for you. It's just amazing. And they knew who was coming. They had sizes if it was clothing and it's just wonderful. I figure when I get home, I'm going to spread it all out and take a picture because nobody would believe, this. It's just amazing. It's an experience I will not soon forget. I can tell you that. What's going on in our city? What's going on in Ohio?
We are sweltering, especially by Northeast Ohio standards. It might get down into the 80s this weekend by the time you're back.
Down into the 80s?
Yeah, we've been in the low 90s pretty much every day this week. So, us fragile Cleveland flowers are wilting, but I guess we better get used to it. The other thing that's going on is Race Across America rolls on.
Yes, and?
Team Hope, Andre Hussein and company, they are consistent like a metronome. I'm telling you, 4 hours and some change between every time station so far along the route, pretty much. Very
wow.
Consistent. Yeah, so they're, as we record this on Thursday, they are rolling through central Missouri on their way toward the Mississippi River.
Okay.
Sadly, not such great news to report about Cassie Schumacher and Wheels for Change. She got as far as western Missouri, about 1,800 miles in, and had to give up her attempt. But, I think it was purely physical from what I understand. She still had the will and the drive to go on, but just ground her up. And I think the 5 hours that she lost early in the race to the stomach thing, they took their toll both in terms of putting her behind on the clock, and I'm sure it didn't help her physically either. But we take our hats off to Cassie and her crew because they did an amazing job, and especially for a first-time solo Ram racer, that's a good result by anybody's standard.
You know what? Hats off is right. I'm really, really proud of her. She's really a tough cookie.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
They are headed back to Ohio. And I'm sure there's some decompression going on from 6 or 7 days of sleep deprivation and such. And so it'll be a few days before they all get back into a routine of normal life.
Well, and when she's ready to talk about it, we'll be ready to listen. I think she probably has some interesting tales to tell.
I would imagine. And I do hope that she will come in and regale us with her firsthand experiences of Race Across America.
Really?
So you've been talking to some interesting folks out in Park City, I understand.
I have. And so the show this evening is really a series of short interviews I've been able to coordinate with a variety of people, both members of the press and some of the vendors. So basically, you're going to hear these short interviews, and I hope you find their stories as compelling and interesting as I did. So without anything, I'm just going to say sit back and enjoy an unusual edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to hear from somebody we've spoken with in the past, Patrick Brady, who is the blogger Red Kite Prayer. So, Patrick, tell us about Press Camp from your perspective.
Sure, Diane. It's a pretty remarkable event. I was interested in attending because it's an opportunity to get real sort of one-on-one time with a lot of manufacturers. So often the only chance I have to meet with people is at Interbike. And those meetings are always kind of rushed. There are interruptions. They're never really as in-depth as what you'd really hope for. And this is a great opportunity to have 45 minutes with somebody who is already generally pretty fascinating and, you know, have a chance to really go through their product line.
This year, it seems like it's been expanded. Now, this is my first press camp. My other one was the Urban Press Camp. But now we've got mountain bike people. We've got road bike people. We've got some of the utility bike type people. Is this growing in a way that maybe it's going to take over some other opportunities that we have, including Interbike?
I would say that I think this is the shape of things to come. I think the business model for a traditional trade show is suffering. I think people are having a tough time finding, you know, a real reward coming out of a big trade show like Interbike. And the erosion that you're seeing in exhibitors at Interbike is backed up by the growth of this event. As soon as I heard about it, just the nature of the event made sense to me. And now that I'm here and having a chance to meet with people, I think it's just been absolutely terrific.
Have you seen anything that just has blown you away so far?
Well, you know, the Neil Pride bikes. I didn't know the line at all. And that's precisely what you want out of something like this,
is right,
to have those revelatory experiences where, you know, you've seen somebody on a bike, but you never really looked them over. And suddenly you have a chance to really get down, look at them, go through a full technical presentation with somebody. And you get to the end of it going, these guys are doing serious work.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I've seen a lot of very committed people, people who really seem to be enjoying the work that they're doing. And it's a little bit out of the mainstream spectrum, like your big carbon fiber road bike manufacturers. Everything's very different out here. I like it. I certainly love the venue. Oh my goodness. It's beautiful here.
This being my first time here, I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't understand the arc of the day better, and I've scheduled meetings all afternoon. So while any number of people are out riding the mountain bike trails and doing road rides and having a spectacular time, I'm going to be diligently doing my job, which I suppose is what I'm supposed to do. But good golly, it's pretty here.
It is. And I got my little wristband. So at some point, I'm going to take the lift up and see the top of the mountain, which my problem yesterday was like huffing and puffing up and down the steps. You know, we're way higher than 800 feet, which is, I think, where Cleveland is.
Yeah, I'm at sea level. So
yeah, right.
I'm drinking water constantly.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you in between appointments talking to us and telling us your impression of Press Camp. And I guess I'll see you at Interbike.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Patrick. We're going to talk with Carlton Reed. Carlton has a really cool website called RoadsWereNotMadeForCars.com. You probably, if you are a cyclist who watches Facebook stuff, he's out on Facebook a lot. He has a lot of books. He has some great ideas, and he's another of the journalists who's here at Press Camp. First, I'd like to just give a little bit of background about who you are and what mm-hmm. you do. You have some wonderful ideas for cyclists.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm the executive editor of bikebiz.com, which is the reason I'm here. So that's a trade website. So I'm interviewing the same people you are, but then I'll do a trade angle on this rather than maybe a consumer angle.
So a trade angle, tell me what that might look like and who would read that.
Well, bikebiz.com is, it's a trade magazine, so okay. It's for bike retailers and it's for the suppliers, but it's because it's open to all, anybody can actually read it.
So. Okay, so it's sort of like Bicycle Retailer
It's the UK equivalent of Bicycle Retailer. So there's it's a monthly print magazine.
Got it. But you also are involved in a website about cars.
Yes.
Which are really about bikes.
Well, the basic premise is that cyclists were the people who actually paved the roads.
Which is true.
Well, whenever I mention this to people who even cyclists don't know this, but certainly, you know, mainstream people who have never come across this concept at all, they're quite staggered that the asphalt that they assumed was slapped down for motorists, well, in many cases was actually slapped down and promoted and lobbied for by cyclists, and a good 20 years before cars came along. So the book is called Roads Were Not Built for Cars.
And it's an e-book?
It's going to be both.
Oh,
it's
good.
It's going to be an e-book and a print book, and it's going to be basically every platform you can think of, it's going to be on there.
Well, so, I know I've posted some of the things you've sort of been leaking a little bit here and there, and it's been so entertaining and interesting. So what kind of progression are you doing it as a progression through time, chronologically, or just...
Right now, I don't know, because I've nearly done the research. I've got two more bits of research to do. So I've been traveling, I'd say the world, but it's not the world. It's been basically America and the UK, because they're the two countries where the cyclists in the 1890s were extremely vociferous, extremely influential. You know, in the 1890s, I think it was the 1896 Republican Party campaign for the president, the only group of people who were in the Republican hotel and in their campaign were the cyclists, were the League of American Wheelmen. There was no other lobby group there. So cyclists were, to now what we think of as the motor lobby as influential, well, that was what the cyclists were like.
So it was the old AAA. Here
absolutely.
We have
absolutely. So cyclists were pushing for roads, pushing for this. And when asphalt came along and they were trying to get asphalt, pushing for all these things, which actually benefited the motorists 20 years later. So Henry Ford in 1926 said, the things that really paved America were cars. And he actually knew that that wasn't the case because he was a cyclist.
Right.
And he was involved with some of the early people in the League of American Wheelmen who were pushing for roads. So he absolutely knew that wasn't the case. But by the 1920s, you know, when America fell in love with the automobile, then the narrative had to change to being, you know, motorists rule, motorists, you know, brought good roads. And of course they didn't. They benefited from the good roads movement started by cyclists.
So do you see any opportunity for some of these old thinking to come around again? Is that starting to happen, sort of? And how is it happening, if it is?
Well, the book that I'm writing... It's a polemic at the end of the day. I mean, the from the very, very first words in the book, the title.
Right.
You know, I'm clearly being quite aggressive. And this is not like a touchy, touchy-feely history book. This is coming right in and saying, look, motorists, you know, you're actually the last people on the highway. You're not dominant on the highway. I know you'd like to feel you're dominant on the highway, but cyclists are actually, and horse riders and pedestrians, the highway is not for cars. The highways are for people, and cars are actually the way I put it in the book, are the Johnny Come Latelys of highway history. You know, they are not necessarily the dominant force going forward. And I think if we look, say, 20, 30 years time, we can see a lot of the things that are probably going to happen in 30 years time. That the small movements coming now. In that a lot of cities, you know, we've got New York is a good example.
It's a great example.
Lots of other cities around the world are thinking, well, maybe this experiment, that's what it is, this experiment that we've had with motor cars and letting them have free access to cities and, in effect, destroying some cities and obviously making other cities. And cars are not, you know, the devil's spawn. Of course, they're extremely useful. But in a city centre, do you really need to have... you know, quite as many asphalt highways and high-level roads and all these different things. And lots of cities around the world are thinking, maybe we don't need quite so much. Maybe we should actually be designing for people. So the book is just exploring some of the concepts that I think will actually be quite important over the next 20 to 30 years to equal the balance and to get back to cities that are not dominated by these little metal cages.
Well, and then you have the issues with lobbies, like the oil lobbies and the automobile lobbies mm-hmm. and whatever other lobbies there are that want to keep cars on the road, which includes bridges and infrastructure mm-hmm. that obviously I hate to use the word fighting with, but we are fighting with it. You know, day in and day out, cyclists feel sort of second-class citizens and are considered that. So I don't know how that's going to change, but I can say that I have, over the last 10 years, seen an enormous shift Absolutely. In an enormous number of people. So when do you think the book will be ready? Do you have any end date? Do you have
So I'm leaking bits on Roads Were Not Built for Cars.com. And then when the book itself comes out, it will be, in some shape or form, free. Because the whole reason for this book, because it's a polemic, I don't want it to be, you know, sell 500 copies and sit on a musty, dusty library shelf somewhere. It never gets read. So my concept with the publications that I produce, they're always going to be free. And that's so the message gets out there. And people think, well, why are you doing this for free? Well, I've actually got grants...
Sure.
To do this, so I'm not I'm not losing money
right.
by
it's
doing
not
this.
Totally altruistic.
It's
right.
not altruistic. You know, I'm making money. This is a profitable book for me.
Good.
This is not something that I'm doing, you know, just purely for the good of my
out
heart.
Out of love,
no.
right?
I mean, I am extremely passionate about it.
Yes.
But I can't take time out of my day if I'm not actually, you know, making money.
No, you have to put food on the table.
Yes. So because in my position in the bike trade, I've got lots of people. In the bike trade to sponsor it. So some versions of the book will have, say, advertising in it, and they will be free. If somebody wanted, you know, a nice, pristine copy without any advertising, then, of course, they can pay for that, and it'll come in a print form for that.
Interesting. What an interesting way to go about it. I like it. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners who are speaking with Carlton Reed about his soon-to-be-published, I hope, book, Roads Were Not Built for Cars, which some people argue... that's not true, but if anybody goes back in time and knows the history of the LAB and whatever. So what is the cycling organization in the UK? It's not called the LAB.
It's the Cyclist Touring Club.
Oh,
now,
CTC.
Now abbreviated to
okay.
CTC, yes. And the CTC and the League of American Wheelmen were roughly founded at about the same time. Actually, a lot of the Wheelmen's organization actually copied quite a few of the things that the CTC were doing. But the CTC and the League of American Wheelmen both founded roads improvement associations long before cars were even dreamt about. I mean, this is the 1880s. They had organizations which were going around both countries to, say, county surveyors and to mayors of cities and saying, we need roads put in place, because... In the 1820s, 1830s, when trains came along,
right,
that totally wiped out road traffic. You know, in town to town, there was virtually no road traffic because railways had taken all the long and short distance people off the roads, because before that was stagecoaches and
sure.
et cetera.
Horses.
So for 70 years, basically nobody, literally nobody, was using the roads. And a lot of people were saying, well, why should we ever pay for roads again? We've got these railways. And then these bolshy cyclists came along who were all middle class, they were rich, influential, and they said, no, we want roads resurrected so we can go on our pleasure rides. And it was those bunch of, and it was men and women, because obviously women were extremely influential within the world of cycling, and cycling was a platform for women, you know, to get emancipation in many ways for you know, what they were wearing,
right.
et cetera, et cetera. And the radicalization of the women's movement partly came out of cycling.
Right.
I think that's relatively well known now. So the CTC and the Wheelmen were promoting roads for relatively non-altruistic reasons.
Right.
They wanted roads so they could go riding. But from the very first days, they recognized that this would be a benefit to society as a whole, and that's what they always pushed to the localities and to national government. I mean, there was huge petitions, for instance, to national government, both mostly in the US, in fact, to get a better road system and to put in place funding for roads.
Right.
And then that history has been forgotten. So that's what I'm trying to resurrect this forgotten history of we owe cyclists, and I'm a cyclist, obviously, and you're a cyclist. Society owes cyclists a bigger debt than is normally believed. And when you mention that to people, it totally blows their mind.
Yeah, they're like, what are you talking about?
Bicycles for poor people. Why would this be the case? It's like, no, in the 1890s, highly, highly influential. And a lot of the stuff that you take for granted, well, very potentially, that came about because of these, what you consider, you know, the guys in spandex. Well, the right. Guys in spandex in the 1890s, the equivalents,
right.
That you should thank them.
Thank you. Thank you, guys, not in spandex in the 1890s. Well, you know, I'm so glad I finally got to catch up with you. I know that you're ready to meet your appointments for the day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to meet mine. And I'll be looking for the book. So once again, if you'll tell our listeners the name of the book and the name of your website, I would appreciate that.
Well, just put a .com on the end of Roads Were Not Built for Cars.
Okay. And we'll look for the publication of that in the future. Thanks, Carlton.
Thank you.
Have a great time at press camp and a good trip back home.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Catherine Fuller, who is the communication specialist with IMBA, spoke to us at one of our breakfasts here at press camp. And I really was taken with all the things that IMBA are doing. So I thought it would be nice to talk with Catherine. So our next guest is Catherine Fuller from IMBA.
So welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So you actually sponsored one of the breakfasts this week, and you said some really interesting things about IMBA, and especially about Park City. Park City is the only gold city for IMBA. How did that happen, and why is Park City such a great place for IMBA and mountain biking?
Yeah, Park City is IMBA's first and only gold-level ride center in the entire world. And it started really in 2008 when IMBA hosted its World Summit here in Park City. And they really were inspired by the diverse local mountain bike community, the incredible riding opportunities, and the natural beauty. And from then, it really kind of snowballed from there. The city has a true commitment to master planning for trails. The whole town is behind trails. They function as a cohesive network. There's great signs. You know, you can access beginner and intermediate trails from town, or you can get some really gnarly fun downhill stuff lift assisted. So and also what's really important for top level ride centers too is there's an incredible IMBA-affiliated group called the Mountain Trails Foundation, and they are working hard behind the scenes to do everything from advocacy to organizing to building great trails.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, it is beautiful here, and I can see why people would want to come here and ride. I know in the winter it's like a big ski place. So is IMBA growing? It's been around a long time. It's one of the earlier sort of advocacy organizations. What does it look like growth-wise?
IMBA is absolutely growing. We've been around, we're coming up on our 25th anniversary. It was founded in 1988. And so far, our growth is close to 30% in membership over last year. And I think that means that the whole movement is growing. And people really realize that, you know, unfortunately, as mountain bikers, we're not always welcome everywhere. And so people are seeing that we're fighting for access, and we're also, IMBA and its affiliates, are building and maintaining great trails in their backyards. So things are looking really good, and they have been for a long time.
Well, 30% is an enormous number in this day of everybody wanting to know what numbers are all about. So what do you think would encourage people who would be new to mountain biking would be the most important thing? So if I were to say, I'm going to go out and I want to ride single track, or I want to try a mountain bike, how can IMBA sort of help? Do you have resources that they can go to?
Absolutely. On IMBA.com, we have an entire resources section that talks about everything from trail building to taking your kids out for their first mountain bike ride. And so we really cover a wide gamut. And then, of course, we also have resources that point people toward their local IMBA-affiliated clubs and chapters who are really doing the brunt of the work on the ground, and they're fantastic local resources to get involved with.
Well, I know that on the table in the morning of the IMBA breakfast, there was a new publication about kids, and we like the idea of bringing children into cycling, regardless of whether it's on the road, on the track, on a mountain bike. So explain that publication, and is it available to other people?
Yes, thanks to a generous grant from Shimano, we have published our first issue of IMBA Trail News Youth Edition. And this the first one just came out. We're probably going to do a second one in late fall, early winter. And the whole goal is to introduce mountain biking to young kids and their parents and people who might be involved with youth. And so this first issue is geared toward middle and young high school age students and their parents, their scout leaders, whoever might be involved, and to kind of show how much fun it is, but also how you can organize a successful youth ride. We talk a lot about other youth resources, such as the National Interscholastic Cycling Association, which organizes high school racing teams, everything down to Trips for Kids, which does mountain biking for underserved youth. So it's really kind of introducing people not only to what we can offer, but what all is out there for youth and mountain biking, and that it really shouldn't be this kind of scary thing that moms should be afraid of because the kids are really going to hurt themselves. There's a lot you can do as a family. And the Outdoor Industry Association actually just released a study of outdoor activities and participation that showed that biking is one of the top gateway sports to get kids introduced to the outdoors. And so we're finding that they love it. And so hopefully this publication will kind of demystify it a little bit. And it is available for free on IMBA.com. If you go to our store, you can order them in batches of, I believe, 25 and just pay the cost of shipping, which is about $5. So it's also available online. You can read it for free. And so, yeah, we hope that people will see that as a resource and give us feedback to how we can expand it.
Well, we talk a lot on the show about not only bringing kids into the sport, but the problem kids are having today about not being outdoors at all. So it's really a cool publication. I leafed through it at breakfast and saw some really interesting information. So if you can get out there, IMBA.com, I think that's a good idea. Well, Catherine, thanks for taking time out of your busy day to talk to us on The Outspoken Cyclist. And have fun at press camp the last day, and I'll probably see you at Interbike.
All right. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more of my coverage from press camp in Park City, Utah. I'm Diane Lees, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
On Saturday, June 23rd, the North Coast Men's Chorus proudly kicks off their 25th anniversary season with a special one-night-only performance featuring guest artist and Tony Award winner Brian Stokes Mitchell. Dubbed the last leading man, this baritone has been one of the central leading men of Broadway theater since the early 1990s and won a Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical in 2000 for his performance in Kiss Me, Kate. More information at ncmchorus.org.
I'm Diane Lees. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back with more coverage from press camp in Park City, Utah. There is an auction going on for the benefit of IMBA, the International Mountain Biking Association, and that auction is being sponsored by Niner Bikes. And we have with us Carla Hookey from Niner Bikes to explain the auction, which is really interesting.
Hi, Carla. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So tell us about Niner and about your position and about your auction.
Well, my name's Carla, as you said, and I work for Niner Bikes. I'm the brand manager. So if it says Niner, I looked at it. And we're a very small company, so we all wear a lot of hats. We were founded in 2004. We only make 29er mountain bikes, passion, commitment, 29ers only. And we're pretty proud of the fact that since our inception, we've supported the International Mountain Bike Association.
Right.
That even includes during our rough little startup years. You know, you don't make a lot of cash when you start a company, But the president of the company, Chris Dugay, has made sure that even in our very smallest years and very, very earliest years, we supported the company that makes our company possible.
So when you say you support IMBA, what does that look like?
Well, we have several projects that we've implemented in the years. We started with just simple things like being IMBA members and cash donations to IMBA.
Okay.
And we've moved it now to 5 different initiatives for IMBA. We have products that we sell on our website whose benefit goes to IMBA. We have products that go through shop employees with required $10 donations to IMBA. We have our IMBA membership, our IMBA corporate above and beyond membership, which we're very proud of because we only have 24 employees and everybody else is SRAM, Shimano, Cannondale, companies like that that have far more employees and a lot more resources than we do. But we feel it's really important for medium and small companies to participate. You know, there's the long tail effect. There are only a few big companies,
right?
But there are many, many small companies, and we have a lot of power if we all work together to support something.
No question about it that, you know, every small donation starts building towards a bigger one. So when you produce your bikes, is there a give back with the bike itself, or is it just through your programs?
Right now it is just through our programs. Yeah. We have, once a year, we do some sort of major IMBA benefit that has a lot of promotion behind it. We get the local media behind it. That's what's really great about Press Camp is it's our opportunity to go to everybody at the magazines and say, you have to support this. You got to get out there and support IMBA. And I think it's a little harder to say no when I'm looking at them in their eyes.
No kidding. They can't say no. And this is that time of year.
Yes, it
so
is.
So this year's benefit for IMBA is...
We have produced 6 custom bikes, custom painted bikes, from our brand new Sur9 model, which is a beautiful new steel hardtail. We're pretty sure that this is the very first time any company has dedicated the entire product launch to IMBA. You can get one of these bikes as a production model in 12 weeks, but if you want to be one of those people that has that bike now,
right,
you absolutely have to participate in the auction. It's the only way to get it. There are only 6 of them, and everybody's going to know that you supported IMBA when you're riding that thing out on the trail.
So how does the auction work?
All you have to do is go to the Niner Facebook page, and I have a link to the auction right there.
Okay.
People can just link straight to all 6 bikes. There's 1 small, 2 mediums, 2 larges, and 1 extra large. And we will... probably issue a running tally every day, keep people excited and informed via that Facebook page. The address is www.facebook.com/NinerBikes, NinerBikes.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about the bikes themselves. What are the custom paint jobs and how did you choose those?
Well, every year we pick a model that is going to represent what we are most excited about and then we give it that custom IMBA paint. We did it in conjunction with Spectrum. They gave us a really nice deal on the paint and have been very supportive of our program since we implemented it. We chose the Sur9 this year because it is a bike that you can ride as either a geared or a single speed bike.
Okay.
And there's something about single speeds that harkens back to that first joy you had on a bike as a child. And sometimes, you know, you just get out there on a bike like that. It's silent. It's simple. There's no shifting. There's nothing confusing. There's nothing that's going to distract from the sound of the wind and the leaves and the quiet that you encounter when you're out on the trail. And we feel that that really supports what IMBA's mission is all about. It's about getting people out into the open. It's about having trail systems for kids to access. And it's about having a resource that makes your community healthy. It makes your, you know, if you're a bike company, it makes your business healthy and, you know, is great for everybody.
So whose idea was it to just build Niners?
That would be Chris, our founder. You know, Niner was born on a Wednesday night friends ride. Chris actually had a different business when this was founded. You know, we just went out and he's very dedicated to it and we all agree with him. So we're happy to support him as his dedicated army of 24 and
the marching soldiers.
Yes, we're a small troop, but we're a dedicated troop.
Well.
And we you know, we just know that this wheel size is easier for people to ride. It makes new riders more confident, and it makes really skilled riders faster and, you know, able to conquer harder and tougher problems. It's a great wheel size, and we're really happy to build bikes that are dedicated geometry-wise, function-wise, technology-wise, specifically to being the best 29ers in the business.
Well, let me tell you how your auction is doing right now. Every single bike has, looks like a minimum of 15 bids on it.
That is fantastic.
It's fabulous. You're doing so well. Do you have a goal for the auction? I mean,
can you speak it out loud,
or are you like, no, this, I'm keeping this to myself?
Well, last year's auction, we raised over $23,000.
Wow.
And I would, in my heart, that would make me absolutely happy. If we could show that the Ninerds out there, and you all know who you are, if we could show that we're the most giving and supportive people in bikes, that would make my day. So,
well, what's really interesting is that the bikes are beautiful. They really are beautiful. So once again, it's, give them the website for the
www.facebook.com/NinerBikes, NINERBIKES.
Okay, very good. The auction started at 99 cents. I can tell you, peeps, it's way up there right now. So I hope you do make a lot of money. I really appreciate you taking time. I know you have just been slammed with interviews, as have we all. And thanks for talking to me on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Thank you so much.
All right, Carla.
We really are excited about the opportunity to help IMBA.
How about we check back in when it's over?
That would be really awesome.
All right.
I'd love it.
Thanks. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Too.
One of the things I did when I was at Urban Press Camp was ride a bicycle that had a new Vinci hub, and I really enjoyed it. So I had to get into the new Vinci condominium here at Park City, and I spoke with the head of sales, Avelino Rivera, from new Vinci.
Avelino, tell us about new Vinci and about what's happening for 2013 and with this new sort of internally geared market.
Yeah, no problem. So my name is Avelino. I do all the sales for North America. So for 2013, we've got some new models coming out here in the United States, and we're also launching some new products ourselves with our Harmony auto shift system that is integrated into the N360.
Okay, and the N360 is now lighter than it used to be.
The N360 is lighter than the N171. So
okay.
The N360 is the third generation of new Vinci product. It is a result of a lot of the learnings that we had in Fallbrook from some of our automotive division that allowed us to take a lot of their learnings and make it 30% lighter, shift better under load, shift much quicker. And so we've been able to have some good success with that here in the States and in Europe. And now for 2013, we have some customers who are integrating our new auto shift system onto their e-bikes.
So explain a little bit about how new Vinci actually works. I mean, I know it's got balls.
Yes. Yeah. No. So it's a continuously variable transmission. Instead of actually having gears inside, it has spheres. So what you're basically able to do is you're able to twist these spheres back and forth. And I kind of would make it akin to, if you could imagine a cassette and imagine instead of 9 or 10 or 11, imagine that there was infinitely small gaps between each of those gears and you were able to move the chain up and down smoothly. That's essentially what's happening within the N360 hub.
And so it has a range akin to a pretty much anything that anybody would, under most circumstances, be able to use, and then some of them have actually electric assist too.
That's correct. So the range is going to be equivalent to about a 2x9 setup. So for a lot of the bikes that we get spec'd on, we by and large end up on commuter bikes, utility bikes, cargo bikes, and e-bikes. So in particular for the e-bike, once you have that assist, the range that the N360 offers is more than enough than you would need in a city type application.
So, you know, there was some concern, at least on my part, because I can remember years ago we had those little, I don't know if you'd call them mopeds or not, but you got to the point you could only have them be so fast before they became something licensable, which of course then the government could make some money. But so how much does the electric assist actually? How does that work?
Well, I'll tell you that between Europe and the United States, it's different. Because Europe, e-bikes are so prevalent, the manufacturers of those bikes are held to strict standards on both the power of the motor and the top speed which they're able to achieve. So it's basically a little bit less than 30 miles per hour. Here in the States, the laws are a bit grayer, and especially depending on which state you're in. Very often, the law will read something like, as long as it has pedals and it's not an internal combustion engine, it's still a bicycle. So there are people who are putting motors that technically in some states would not be legal, but it's not of a large enough concern that I have seen that any of the Department of Public Safety or the Consumer Product Safety Commission is getting involved. So here in the States, very often too, what people are after is, I want to go as fast as I can. I would like to be able to simply throttle instead of being able to pedal. Whereas in Europe, there are specific laws that require you to pedal in order for the electronic assist to even come on, in addition to some of those limitations they put on motor size and vehicle top speed.
Okay, I get what that's all about. I have a question that didn't occur to me before, and that is, are you getting involved with any of the bike share programs?
You know, it's something that we've looked at here in the States, and in particular, I know that in Europe, we have a number of bike share fleets, one in Germany, and part of the reason is that it is such a low maintenance system and that the average person that is using those bikes are not necessarily, again, enthusiasts or highly accustomed to riding a bike. So having something that's very simple to use for the rider and for, again, the owner of the bike share program, having something that's very low maintenance and that they don't need to, update or have a lot of upkeep, we have seen some real success with.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's like a perfect marriage. Why wouldn't you want something that is really low maintenance, because people are not going to take care of these bikes particularly well.
Correct, right. It's yeah. about as good a care of it as you do a rental car.
Right. Exactly, right. And you leave your wrappers on the, whatever.
Right.
So one of the things that's not really new, because Gates Drive have been around a while, but now you're pairing the Gates Drive with the new Vinci Hub. And so now you go from quiet to totally silent and less maintenance yet.
Absolutely. So Gates is a fantastic product. It's a carbon fiber belt that basically takes all the maintenance out of the chain-driven drivetrain. Couple that with the new Vinci, which has very, very little to no maintenance already, and you've got a system that is both very, very smooth in terms of when you start to put power down, and it's also incredibly quiet. The new Vinci Hub by itself, again, is very quiet. The Gates is very quiet. The two together complement each other very well.
So I know that it probably drives the cost of the bike up a little bit to go New Vinci and Gates and all of that. But what happens with maintenance? I mean, how much maintenance does the hub need?
The internals of the hub is never anything that a bicycle shop will need to see the insides of. It is fill for life with a special kind of what we call traction fluid that was developed specifically for this hub by Valvoline. It never needs to be added to, refilled, or cleaned. We've done countless amounts of durability, life cycle testing that shows with the power that a human and or an e-bike plus a human rider is able to put out, it will far exceed any other part of the bicycle. You'll be replacing other parts of the bicycle before you'll be replacing the hub.
Well, and that's the question. So is that what happens? So if something breaks, you're going to replace the hub. You're going to replace the wheel.
Correct.
Wow. Not too many failures, I take it?
No.
Of course not.
I'll tell you that, you know, our previous generations of the hub were actually very, the N170, the N171, were very popular with the motorized bike community. It is a small niche here in the States, but these are guys that are putting 1.5 to 5 horsepower engines directly powered into the hub. You would not be able to do that with virtually any other bicycle train, a drivetrain, be it an internally geared hub, a derailleur, without some kind of malfunction. So that's kind of still a testament to how internally durable the hubs are. And I know that from some of the testing that we've done, it shows that the N360 will be able to surpass the internal durability of our previous two generations.
So here's a question that also never occurred to me till now. So if let's say we wanted to buy one of these hubs and lace it into a wheel, it's 36 hole?
It's 36 and 32.
Oh, you do offer it in both drillings.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yep, both drillings, and it'll be it. You have the ability to order it with a Shimano roller brake spline, a 6-bolt disc, or a rim brake, and there's no cost difference between the three.
And the width is 135?
That's correct.
See how smart I am sometimes. Mm-hmm. Really, I'm so proud of myself. So let's talk about the future of not just the new Vinci, but of the whole that whole internally geared market.
Yeah.
What kind of growth do you see, or are you projecting for that market?
Well, you know, here in the States, it's of course, you know, the internally geared hub market here is much smaller than it would be in Europe. But I do see that growing. I see a number of people for various reasons wanting to get back into bicycling. And one thing that I often see happen is sometimes in their enthusiasm, they go out and, you know, buy a $300 bike, ride it for maybe a number of weeks or a number of months. But as there come maintenance issues, very often it will sit in the garage. So that enthusiasm is lost. One of the real benefits I see with our hub and with other internally geared hubs is that they tend to work as well in month 6, year 6, as they did during that first day. And I think for people to, you know, really be comfortable and make biking a bigger part of their life, they want something that's really easy to use and they don't really have to do a lot of fussing with or take it to a bike shop in order to get riding again.
Yeah, I think reliability is a really key issue. And I like that idea that, you know, you get the product, it's reliable. Yeah, maybe you need tires. Maybe you need, you know.
Yeah, make sure your tires are pumped up.
Yeah,
and,
right.
But if you can do that, then I think it takes out one of the inhibitors for a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people are not necessarily going to want to load up their bicycle every time, you know, something's wrong with it to take it to the bike shop. So the more that you can ensure that that bike is going to be working 100%, the more that you can ensure that that person is actually going to use it and not have an excuse that, oh, the bike needs adjustment on the derailleur. Instead of going to ride, you know, this Saturday, I'm going to go play a round of golf or do something else.
Yes, and we do not want them doing that. Right. Well, very, very cool. So are you enjoying Press Camp?
I am very much. Press Camp is an excellent opportunity for us to obviously sit down with you guys and get some intimate discussions. But then also to give you guys a real good look at not just the products that we're doing, but, you know, where we see things going and really trying to make our customers successful. Because if I'm able to get my customers' bikes sold, then they'll be ordering more product from me.
That's a very good point. Well, I really appreciate you taking our time that we had and actually doing an interview with me. And I hope you have fun. You have to go back home when? Friday, I guess?
Yep.
Tear down is Friday.
Tear down is Friday.
All right.
I may squeeze a ride or two in, though.
And Interbike?
Interbike will be attending as well.
Okay. Well, yeah. We'll see you there. Thank you so much. And have a great rest of Press Camp.
You too.
All
right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
I never knew who this guy really was, but he's been around the industry a long time. His name is Jimmy Mac McIlvain, and he is the editor of Mountain Bike Action, one of the oldest print magazines in our industry, and it's still out there, and he's a really cool guy.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to see you here. Actually, we've been dining together all week for Press Camp. Why don't you give us your impressions of Press Camp first, and then we're going to talk about your magazine.
Well, this is always a great place to sit down with a few select suppliers of either parts or bikes and really get into some in-depth discussions about new technologies or new ideas that they're bouncing off of us. So it's just a great one-on-one time to meet with these people where you don't have a lot of outside distractions.
And so have you seen anything radically new or anything that's really sort of taken your fancy?
Well, the most radically new thing that I just had a blast on yesterday was from Turner Bicycles. They have a prototype here of a new model called the Turner Burner, and it's a short travel trail bike that uses 27.5-inch wheels. So that's an in-between size. Most people know mountain bikes as either 26-inch wheels or 29-inch wheels. And then this is kind of a new arrival using an old technology that's been around. But it falls somewhere in between, and it's almost the best of both worlds. It pedals very much like with the liveliness of a 26-inch wheel, but it still gives you some of the rolling characteristics of a 29er. So anyway, I got to ride that. It's a prototype, so I'm not going to tell you what I thought of it because it could be quite different by the time he does a production version. But that's been the highlight of the camp for sure.
So just to expand on that a tiny bit, so what about tire choices?
Well, tire choices are increasing every day. And that's the other thing. I just met with Hutchinson, one of the tire companies here, and they showed us a full line of the 650B or 27.5-inch. It depends.
Okay,
in
that's
Europe,
the
it's called 650B. I like to call it 27.5, 27.5-inch, because it falls into the range better. So a rider coming into a bike shop can understand, I think, better where it fits into the hierarchy of the wheel sizes than if you say 650B. It's a little confusing for someone outside of cycling to understand what that is.
Right, yeah. You know, it's bead diameters, and if people don't go by that.
Exactly.
They go by what's written on the side of the tire. So tell us a little bit about Mountain Bike Action. It's been around a long time.
Yeah, 25 years as of last year. So, and I've been fortunate enough to be editor going on a little over 10 years now.
Wow.
So I have 120 issues under my belt, and we're still having a blast. I think Mountain Bike Action it's always been the technical magazine. We do a lot of product testing, a lot of bike testing. And we like to help riders, once they get their equipment, to use it properly. So you see a lot of technical stories and a lot of how-to stories, not just technical how-tos, but on the bike, how to ride switchbacks, how to use the brakes properly. And as you see new technologies come in, like dropper seat posts, where there are these new seat posts that will drop 3 or 4 inches with the push of a button, and it really helps you when you're descending on a mountain bike. But there are some tricks to using that. So we try to address new technologies and how you can change your riding style or adapt your riding style to get the most out of it.
So why do you think Mountain Bike Action, which is basically a print publication, you said, I know when we were talking before, that it has an online presence, but it certainly isn't where everything is. Why do you think it's been so sustainable?
You know, I think it's because the staff stays relatively stable over the years. We have so much experience, and I'm the first one to say Jimmy Mack is not a professional level rider. There's tons of riders who are faster than me and can jump higher than me and all that, but I have 10 years of testing bikes underneath my belt, and before that I worked for Bell Helmets, I've worked for JT Racing, Troy Lee Designs, so I've been in cycling a long time, and I think you get a consistency there with other magazines that have newer people more often. It's hard to really build up the trust that you can have in Mountain Bike Action.
So, from your
I sound like I'm really tooting our horn a little bit too
much.
Well,
that's
there,
okay. That's why you're on the show, to toot your horn. You're allowed to do that here.
It's experience.
And experience counts for a lot. So when you look at the market today, and you kind of think back over the years of mountain biking, how do you think mountain biking today is faring, and is it going to grow? And if it is, what's going to help it grow?
Sure. And this might surprise a lot of people because, of course, a magazine like ours, we thrive on new technologies and writing about new technologies. But I've seen a trend where the manufacturers and component companies are really catering to the high-end user, the hardcore guy. And I think it makes it pretty intimidating for a newer rider to get into our sport. And my idea of the perfect suspension or the perfect drivetrain is not something that needs more input from a rider, but less input. And right now, a trend with adjustability, I think, has swung a little too far to all these external adjustments and remote levers and buttons and all that, where it's made mountain biking a lot more complicated. Now, of course, you can dial it in, and that's the beauty of it for an experienced rider. But I know when I take friends out who are fairly new to the sport, it's quite intimidating.
Yeah, so simple is often better.
I would love to see us go back, put the pressure on the suspension companies and the drivetrain companies, everyone, to make products simpler for the rider.
Do you think some of these adjustments, these new external adjustments and dropping seat posts and all of that, have any inherent danger?
No, in fact, probably the opposite.
Okay.
The dropping seat posts and all that, I think, actually would make most riders more comfortable descending. And what I've seen with 29-inch wheels has made mountain biking a lot better for beginners, especially. It flattens out the learning curve. So new technologies, I think, create mountain bikes that have better control and better adjustability. But you also have to invest a lot of time in understanding some of that technology to get the most out of it.
Yeah, so that your casual rider is better off with just a simple bike. And there are still some plain old rigid mountain bikes with little suspension forks.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I'm going to let you get back to what you're doing. You're going for a ride.
I'm going to go for a ride. Mid-Mountain Trail, all kidding aside, Mid-Mountain Trail in Park City, Utah is my favorite ride.
How long is it?
It can be up to 20 miles long.
Okay.
So and the neat thing about it is it's just like the name implies. It's right in the mid-mountain, so you don't have a lot of climbs. You don't have a lot of descents. It's just rolling, fun, single track through beautiful trees. And if ever you get tired, you just hang a left-hand turn and go down to town, and you take the bus back up the mountain. I mean, this is really just a great place. If you've never been able to get out here, I could highly recommend Park
well,
City for riding.
It is IMBA's only gold level
destination. Yeah.
It's awesome. And everybody
deserves
here.
It.
Yeah,
it
everybody here has been great. Well, Jimmy, thank you for joining me on the show, and enjoy the rest of your press camp, and I'll see you at Interbike.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So what did you think of the interviews, Greg? Did you enjoy my time at press camp?
I did. Vicariously, I feel like I was there with you.
Well, there'll be coming up in future shows many more interviews with some of the people I met here at press camp. And there are a lot of interesting stories. Again, I really enjoyed it, and I hope listeners enjoyed hearing about it.
All right. We'll be back next week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Until then, ride safe, fly safe, and...
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.